South Korea kicked off yet another round of large-scale military exercises with the U.S. by conducting Air Force drills early this week. South Korea says the joint drills are based on an all-out war scenario and will involve field training and command post exercises and address cyber threats and terrorism. The drills follow the recently concluded trilateral summit with Japan at Camp David, where President Biden warned the DPRK and other countries.
We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs.
The joint U.S.-South Korea drills under President Yoon actually lead to a decline in national security, say some NGO leaders.
If the large-scale military exercises of South Korea and the U.S. continue, North Korea will respond with provocations. And then strategic assets such as fighter bombers of the U.S. forces will be engaged, and the vicious cycle carries on. At this rate, these military exercises will expand further and become regular. So, of course, the tension on the Korean Peninsula will increase.
The DPRK has indicated it will launch a satellite in the coming days as it seeks to bolster its surveillance activities. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has reversed course in much of the country's foreign policy. Engagement with the DPRK has been replaced with confrontation. And while U.S. President Biden praises President Yoon for his political courage, many South Koreans oppose his policies. Trilateral cooperation with Japan is particularly touchy in South Korea for historical reasons, and opposition to the Fukushima nuclear contaminated water release further damaged sentiment toward Japan. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Change in the world can come if nations function on the principle of mutual cooperation and respect. But the imperative is to break free from the status quo, and BRICS leaders have a number of proposals they want implemented to realize this. Among the most urgent being accelerating de-dollarization, establishing a common currency, and countering Western-imposed sanctions.
Through the new development bank, we can offer our own alternatives for the adequate financing that will attend to the needs of the global south. Through the help of my sister Dilma Rousseff, the bank will manage to face the challenges. The creation of a common vetted unit for our trade transactions and investments for BRICS countries will increase payment options and reduce our vulnerabilities.
With an increasing number of countries wanting to join BRICS, the group presents prospects of prosperity, cooperation and development. As the sessions were underway here, India successfully landed its Chandrayaan 3 mission on the moon. And this is the type of expertise and know-how that can hopefully be shared through a mechanism such as BRICS.
Through initiatives such as the BRICS satellite constellation, the vaccine R&D center, mutual recognition of pharma products, we are bringing about positive changes in the lives of ordinary citizens in BRICS countries. Through initiatives such as the Youth Summit, BRICS Games, the Think Tanks Council, we are strengthening people-to-people ties in all countries.
The West's reliance on sanctions has inadvertently strengthened those it wanted to isolate. Russia highlighted how sanctions have hampered the international economic system. And even with traditional allies of the United States, such as Saudi Arabia, knocking at BRICS's door, change looks very much possible. BRICS now stands on the threshold of becoming a far more influential body, one which will shape a new world order and present a true challenge to the West's stranglehold. The final day of deliberations, which will look at expansion, will decide its future. Hassan Siriyap, Santon.
Money laundering. Simply put, it means one conceals the origin of the money obtained from illicit activities. The term money laundering is said to have its origins in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. Most gangsters, such as Al Capone, used laundries as a cover for the illegal money they made because the amount of cash flowing into laundry operations was challenging to track. This way, large sums of money could be processed without being noticed. Governments have been dealing with this issue for decades, working hard to put an end to it. In 2008, Iran established the Economy Ministry's Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, headed by the country's economy minister for this purpose. On Tuesday, the FIU held Iran's first national anti-money laundering and financing terrorism conference in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 senior managers from different institutions took part in this seminar to discuss strengthening and developing necessary infrastructure to prevent and deal with corruption, especially money laundering. Speaking on the sidelines of the conference, Iran's economy minister Ehsan Khanduzi said the Islamic Republic has higher standards in blocking the path of money laundering and financing terrorism compared to many countries in the world.
According to the financial and judicial reports, important measures have been taken in Iran in the field of fighting against money laundering and financing terrorism, which is unprecedented. We expect the FATF working group to adopt a technical approach in its evaluation instead of a political approach.
Khanduzi also pointed to Iran's membership at the Financial Action Task Force, saying Tehran's position in the FATF is active, not passive. Organizers of the conference say it has provided a perfect platform for the senior managers of Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Keeping Iran's financial system healthy is one of the priorities of the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi. In this regard, Tehran has been taking serious steps to combat money laundering and deal with disruptors of the economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
On almost every commercial street in the Belgian capital, there is evidence of failed businesses. The country's statistics office recorded 1,092 bankruptcies in June alone. Bridi Said has been in business for 30 years. He says things have never been so tough.
Difficult to find the rent. Rent is expensive and a lot of things together. And the war, sure, and the war.
Across the 27 countries that make up the EU, bankruptcies increased by 8% in April, May and June compared to the previous 3 months. That's according to Eurostat, the bloc's statistical office, which says the increases are at their highest since it began collating such data in 2015. We've raised the issue with the European Commission.
What are the EU authorities doing to try and support these firms under pressure?
The answer was, we'll get back to you with a response. Many analysts say high inflation and rising interest rates are happening in the EU because sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. The bloc is sending deadly weapons worth billions of euro to Ukraine amid growing calls for peace talks. This is a subject we also asked the bloc's executive arm about.
Is there a realisation within the EU that, you know, this current war as it stands, it's unwinnable?
Hopefully they will win. Hopefully they will win soon. We are supporting Ukraine. We will support Ukraine for as long as it gets. Of course we want to see peace, but the peace needs to be on Ukrainian terms.
The EU released a further 1.5 billion euro to the Ukrainian government on Tuesday. Back home, the social crisis is deepening and millions are struggling to pay their mortgages due to interest rate hikes. The knock-on effect of bankruptcies could be disastrous. Experts warn. If unemployment rises sharply, which many business insiders say now seems inevitable, extra pressure will be placed on already strained social welfare systems. An unprecedented economic crisis could be in store for the EU. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida toured the water treatment facility of the Fukushima power plant on Sunday. Tuesday, the Tokyo Electric Company announced the plant's contaminated wastewater would be released beginning as early as Thursday.
We will continue to steadily advance the decommissioning process of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant and proceed with the measures dealing with the treated wastewater, while placing the highest priority on safety.
In Seoul, South Korean activists scuffled with riot police trying to contain their protest. Protesters argue that the measures to dispose of the water should be investigated and warn of the risks of the impending ocean release.
When the nuclear contaminated water is discharged into the ocean, it will spread around the entire world. Even if there is no problem for now, in the long term, it could cause radiation exposure and destroy the ocean ecosystem.
Since the nuclear accident in 2011, water used to cool the nuclear reactor's molten core has been stored, with available tank space nearing full capacity.
The South Korean government's response to Japan's plan to release the nuclear-contaminated water from the Fukushima power plant has been muted. President Yoon Suk-yeol has prioritized strengthening the country's alliance with the United States and Japan at the expense of the environment.
While the environmental damage of the release of the wastewater may be severe, fishers in Japan and the region are also concerned about reputational damage. Opposition South Korean lawmakers have objected that the president's priorities are confused.
Of course, the Japanese government can lie for their sake and for TEPCO. But why is Yoon Suk-yeol's administration representing the Japanese government and TEPCO rather than our people?
Japan's release of the nuclear wastewater is scheduled to take decades to complete. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The vice chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, and party's former secretary general, Asad Umar, have been arrested by the authorities after being accused of misusing a secret official document. Under the country's Official Secrets Act, on disclosing the contents of a diplomatic cipher for political gains, the counter-terrorism wing of Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency registered a case against the two former federal ministers, along with ex-premier Imran Khan. Khan was sacked from power in April 2022 after he lost a no-confidence vote in parliament. Since then, he has been accusing the United States of hatching a conspiracy with the help of his political opponents and the military to remove him from power through a diplomatic cipher. Khan is currently serving three-year jail sentence after a court found him guilty in a corruption case earlier this month. He has also been barred from taking part in politics for 5 years. Just moments before his arrest late on Saturday, the former Pakistani foreign minister Qureshi condemned what he called a widening crackdown on his party by the interim government. He said that his party will knock on the door of the country's top court to ensure that the elections be held on time in a free and fair manner.
It was unfortunate that PTI leaders were being arrested and then released after an announcement that they want to part ways with PTI. The caretaker prime minister has said that he will ensure transparent elections. I would ask him how he will do so in such an environment. I would request the Chief Justice of Pakistan and the Election Commission to take notice and ensure a level playing field for PTI.
Political analysts believe that the upcoming polls would be considered as one of the most controversial elections in the history of the country in the absence of one of Pakistan's popular political parties, the PTI.
The chief of PTI, Imran Khan, is in jail. The number two of that party, the vice chairman of PTI, is also arrested in the cipher case. So it looks that the PTI is going to be in a very disadvantageous position in the coming elections. The PTI also claims that thousands of its activists and political workers are in jail and they'll be tried in the military courts.
In the light of the possibility that the general elections may be delayed due to Election Commission of Pakistan's decision to hold new delimitations, major political parties strongly condemned ECP decision, warning that the unconstitutional postponement of elections could escalate into political instability and uncertainty.
According to the political commentators, if the current caretaker setup stretches beyond its constitutional tenure, a lingering period without an elected government could lead to military intervention in the cash-strapped country. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
Welcome to Spotlight. The BRICS bloc of emerging economies has agreed to admit several new members, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. The move is seen in line with a push to reshuffle a world order perceived by many independent countries as outdated. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, whose country is set to join BRICS in January 2024, believes new emerging blocs such as BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization can play a pivotal role in confronting unilateralism. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have Yusuf Azizi, international affairs expert, joining us from Washington, D.C. And also we have Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Azizi in Washington. Give us your perspective on the significance of BRICS taking in new members.
I believe the BRICS countries want to show that there are also alternatives to manage the global affairs. And we know that recently they have more than one-third of the GDP of the whole world. They produce this GDP, and they are now the most important bloc of economic bloc in the world. It's more than G7 countries, especially. They consist of more than half of the population of the world. And I believe they wanted to expand their group to Muslim countries, to Western Asia, to other location in the world to, find more ways of trade, for more ways of, doing business without the interference of the G7 countries. And this is the both way benefit for all countries. If I wanted to example of Iran, so Iran is the only countries that between the Caspian Sea and Persian Gulf, Iran has lots of natural resources and a great amount of human resources. Also, Iran has a good amount of influence in the Western Asia region. So, all together deliver the message to the BRICS countries that if Iran joins them, there could be a benefit for these groups to show the world that there are some other alternatives that the previous dynamics of global power led by United States and Western countries.
Gilbert Doctorow, the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, says that Iran's admission to the BRICS group brings both economic and political benefits for the country. Overall, what will BRICS bring to the table for its new members?
BRICS gives them a voice. BRICS establishes them as credible alternative rulers or powers seated at head table of the that is looking after world governance. I think it's important to note that the world is very big, and there were 23 candidate countries that had been identified prior to the Johannesburg gathering as potential new members of BRICS. What we see is, aside from Argentina, which is a special case since it was necessary to satisfy Brazil in order to bring it around to general expansion of BRICS, the five of the six new countries are in Northeast Africa and West Asia. The Middle East, that whole region has been the most turbulent in the last decades. It has been war-ridden, and it has been plagued by wars that were encouraged, provoked by the colonial powers in a divide-and-conquer policy that has caused great damage to the peoples and to the economies of the region. It is notable that both Iran and Saudi Arabia are two of these countries that are simultaneously joining BRICS. It is significant because it tells us that the priorities of the BRICS club are security, peace, and development. Saudi Arabia, like United Arab Emirates, brings to BRICS, to the BRICS Bank, substantial financial contributions, which will enable the expansion of the infrastructure projects that are a major driver of BRICS. So we have these two priorities: peace in the Middle East and in North Africa, which BRICS encourages by bringing in these new members and financing the BRICS Bank, which will ensure the ongoing infrastructure development that is essential for the developing world to reach its potential.
Right, Yusuf Azizi, this is obviously a two-way street. We're talking about the benefits that BRICS will have for its members. How will BRICS benefit from the accession of its new members, namely Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE?
So we know that the great amount of energy resources are happened in the Middle East, in West Asia, in Persian Gulf region. And if you see that the trend of energy going through the Persian Gulf and West Asia to the East Asia in the next 33 decades. So it is totally changing the global dynamics, because in the 20th century and the decades to the 21st century, the energy coming from the Middle East to West, to European countries and the United States, nowadays it is completely different. And securing the peace and stability in the region, in the Middle East, is very essential for India, is very essential for China, and the countries like this emerging global power. They have lots of over billions of population. They need to grow to produce electricity and so on. So these countries has many things to offer. But on the other hand, about the UAE and Saudi Arabia, we know that previously they are a traditional ally of United States and Western countries. And it is very essential and it is very important. I think it's very critical for these countries to decide between going to the BRICS blocs or going to the under the security umbrella of the United States. So as we listened, the Saudi Arabia foreign minister said that we are deciding to about the invitation of the BRICS countries, but previously they showed their interest to join the BRICS. So for Iran, it is easier because Iran, under the heavy sanction of the Western countries, especially the United States, and joining the BRICS provide many economic opportunity for Iran in developing its country.
Gilbert Doctor, on the issue of Iran, Tehran will join BRICS officially at the start of next year. It was recently ratified as an official member of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Is it safe to say that the maximum pressure campaign enacted by the U.S. and attempts by Washington and its allies in isolating Iran has not worked?
Definitely it hasn't worked, and I agree with you. The overriding objective of the United States was isolation and to cast Iran as a pariah state. It is exactly the same game that the United States and its allies in Europe have been playing against Russia ever since February 2022. The isolation game is canceled, is negated by the formation of an expanded club that is becoming an institution of world governance, in which these countries have a very important voice. One of the efforts of the mainstream media in the West, and I think the Financial Times is a perfect example of this, has been tried to present the expansion of BRICS as something that was dictated by China to serve its own interests. That is nonsense. The expansion was guided by two countries at least, and that is both Russia and China, who have a perfectly aligned foreign policy or international geopolitical policy, and who have a great interest in bringing to the world stage a collection of countries that, as my fellow panelists has said, are major producers of hydrocarbons and the world's biggest consumers of hydrocarbons. No such group has existed till now. You've had OPEC as a producers association, but to have a geopolitical club as BRICS is becoming, these two sides to the equation solves another issue of combating the hegemony of the United States, and that is de-dollarization. The single biggest factor in global trade and in denomination of the currencies of trade have been hydrocarbons. This goes back to the 1970s and the creation of the petrodollar. Witnessing today the rapprochement of India, of China, and of the producers of the Middle East or West Asia, we are seeing the basis for de-dollarization in a wholesale way and in a rapid way, because these countries are now moving from dollar-based petroleum and gas quotations in the bourses of Western Europe and the United States to local currencies, the dirham, the renminbi, and so forth. That will be the biggest factor in dethroning the dollar. And dethroning the dollar is the biggest factor in ending U.S. global hegemony.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Azizi, BRICS leaders have all backed the idea of using local currencies to facilitate trade. It's estimated that 80% of trade carried out between Russia and China is settled in either Russian rubles or the Chinese yuan. Russia is also trading with India in rupees. Unpack that for us, and how big of a step is it in the direction of undermining the weight of the U.S. dollar in global trade?
Yeah, so if when previously the sanction is just hitting Iran in Iranian economy, so most of the world maybe don't care about that. But recently, because of the Ukraine-Russia war and sanctioned, heavily sanctioned on Russian economy, so it is very important economy for the world, for the food industry, for the energy market. So all countries in the world, especially in the South, and the countries who are not under the accepting the hegemony of the United States, found out that it is the time, enough is enough, it is the time to find out other resources. And especially it is interesting for me that recently India also speak about the dollarization. We know that recently India and United States has made a lot of relationship, great agreements, and higher their relationship to the strategic partner. But on the other hand, India knows that it needs some alternatives for the future. We know that India didn't follow the United States and Western countries for sanction against Russia. So, this is the beginning of the long way. The BRICS needs to find out a collective financial system. They need to conduct trade using local currencies. And it is heavily benefit Iran, because if BRICS successfully implemented de-dollarization, Iran could have alternative channels to trade with those countries using local currencies. And finally, Iran could circumvent the restriction imposed by the U.S.-led financial system and doing the easier trade mechanism with other countries. So I believe that we are, and the BRICS are on the first steps, but the world knows that they need to doing and going faster and faster to make sure that United States cannot impose sanction and cannot use dollar as an strategic tools for improving its international norm and international request.
Gilbert Doctor, are blocs such as BRICS and the SCO the answer to countering the current global hegemony? Will such bodies eventually have the capacity to reshuffle the current world order and counter unilateralism on the global spectrum?
As we heard during the last 3 days in Johannesburg, and as we see in the declaration that was issued, the 26-page declaration that was issued at the conclusion of the summit, the BRICS countries have not spoken about replacing the international institutions that have guided the world governance since World War II, that is to say the United Nations and the Bretton Woods institutions. What they are talking about is reforming these. Reform has been a subject on the table for several decades now. India was one country that was pushing for it, and other major powers in the global south have been pressing for reform. Needless to say, the G7 countries have fiercely resisted this. By reform, I mean opening up the Security Council to additional members, particularly from the developing world, and moving away from the neoliberal policies that have guided the World Bank in its loans and have used these draconian methods of austerity to control the budgets and finally the politics of the countries receiving money from international development banks. What the BRICS countries are trying to do is to bring their voice to in a collective way to bear on the question of reforming the existing institutions. And they will do that now ad hoc. They are taking up many of the functions of peacekeeping and extending funds to infrastructure development that have been the main themes of the United Nations and of the Bretton Woods institutions. And while setting these up, they are incrementally increasing the pressure on those institutions to avoid being irrelevant.
Yusuf Azizi, BRICS countries, it's in the works. They're planning to create a unified currency as an alternative to the dollar. The Russian President Vladimir Putin said the process of de-dollarization is, quote, irreversible and gaining pace. Now, as popular as it's becoming, this is a long-term and complex goal. But with BRICS expanding its members, many are seeing this as being a big step in the right direction. Talk to us about the likeliness of seeing a BRICS currency. And the big question here is, what's the next step? What's the next move for BRICS in order to challenge the U.S. dollar?
As I told you, I believe that the first step is using the local currencies in trade among these countries, and second, establishing a financial system like the World Bank or IMF, but in the objective of these countries. China has an Asia Development Bank, but it is not clear that it is working for the global market or global people, or it is just working on the Asia side, and also it needs to diversify its members and the stakeholders. So I think that going through having a united currency for these bloc is not something that available in the next year.
So absolutely,
it needs many ways to go through the understanding, main understanding, especially the countries coming to as a new members like Argentina and Iran. They need to have very sophisticated financial system domestically. So it needs many improvement inside those countries to join the BRICS, and all of them could handle the deficiencies of the local government. So I think if these countries like the Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Iran, Egypt, these countries, these important countries, join the BRICS and provide many resources, the human resources, the natural resources, so we can say in the maybe next 10 years, these bloc could provide a united currency for these governments.
Gilbert Doctorow, BRICS Bank, which is officially known as the New Development Bank, in finding alternatives to the dollar, is pushing for the greater use of local currencies. That's an issue that both of you gentlemen brought up. Will that make this bank, the NDB, an alternative to the likes of the IMF and the World Bank, which have unfavorable loan terms and other restrictions that come attached with these loans?
Well, just to reiterate my point, the BRICS countries are not looking to blow up existing institutions. They are looking to to carry out on themselves in an ad hoc way some of the functions which these institutions dating from World War II have become unable to perform properly. And in doing so, and as they increase their membership from what is now approximately 40% of the world's population as they expand, and a very substantial part of the global GDP, they will have the moral authority to pressure these institutions to reform, to change the ways that they choose their administrators, that is, not just to alternate between a European and an American at the head of these banks, and not to impose the draconian, as I mentioned, draconian neoliberal policies that have made their loans so devastating for the developing countries. It is a method of pressure, a method of providing the instrument for reform that has been missing. We have had voices for reform, but we haven't had an instrument for it. And that is about to happen. And I have to say that what is going to come in the next year is as important as what happened in the last 3 days. We heard an expression of will by the BRICS founding members, and that has to be turned into concrete action of an institution, because BRICS can no longer just be a club. And that will happen in the year that Russia is the chairing the BRICS. That comes in the year to Kazan summit 1 year from now. That time will be used well.
Yusuf Azizi, last question to you. With Saudi Arabia adding its name to the list of BRICS countries, and of course the recent Chinese-mediated revival of relations with Iran, looking at all of this from a different vantage point, are countries in the West Asia region, U.S. allies specifically, slowly moving away from the U.S. influence?
Yes, we can see that. But on the other hand, it is a very difficult decision for these countries, because for a long time, their security is under the umbrella of the United States. And the security agenda is not something that within a blink of the eye, you can change it to diversify it to China, Russia, something like that. And we know that the United States has a long history of doing coup and changing the government and, you know, making separation in the country. So it is not very easy for those countries. But on the other hand, they know that the future of the world is going to the multipolar world. So they couldn't rely on United States, just on the United States for their security, for economic, for other things. So we have to see in the next years what's going on with the Saudi-Israeli cooperation and negotiation behind the scene. And it would tell us what is the future and destiny of the Saudi Arabia to join BRICS or not.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Yusuf Azizi, international affairs expert, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, speaking to us from Brussels. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of Spotlight. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's show. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Asylum seekers are going unaccounted for, or in some cases, dying, as they try to evade pushback by the Greek authorities. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Middle East Eye, the fear of pushbacks by the Greek Coast Guard is forcing many asylum seekers to flee into unknown territory to avoid being detained by the authorities when they arrive by boat on the Greek islands. Civil actors have reported a spike in disappearances and even deaths of asylum seekers since 2020, but with a limited NGO presence on the islands, many of these cases are going undocumented. In June 2022, Bashir Abdulkarim Mohammed, a Somali man, arrived by boat on the Greek island of Chios, one of about 32 people who had boarded the vessel in Turkey. As soon as they came ashore, the group quickly dispersed, fearing detection by the authorities. Mohammed with 11 others fled to the mountains. Mohammed told Middle East Eye via an interpreter, "We were up there for 5 days. When they reached a point that was too risky to cross, the women in the group refused to turn back. They said they'd rather risk their lives than go back," he said. Mohammed and three other men decided to turn back to bring them water as they had not drunk any for days. On the way down, they were intercepted by police. He said, "We told them that there were people still stranded on the mountain." Mohammed insisted that he wanted to take the women food and drink himself, but the police assured them that they would send a rescue team, adding, "They kept repeating that they were safe in Europe." Mohammed was taken to a camp. He was then transferred to an airless container, his arms painfully bound with cables, then put on a boat and deposited on an island between Greece and Turkey. His phone was taken from him and he was left with nothing but a life vest. Mohammed later found out that the body of one of the women, 24-year-old Hoda Hussein Adan, had been discovered. A coroner's report later said she had died of exhaustion due to hunger and thirst. Mohammed said, "I couldn't take this. It was too much for me. The authorities must have gone too late. They just went to collect the bodies." According to Ruhi Lauren Akhtar, CEO of Refugee Biryani and Bananas, two other women who went missing have still not been found. Akhtar said the ombudsman was contacted. Different agencies were contacted, asking for a search to happen, but that never happened. There was no accountability about what happened to this woman. Akhtar and Maddie Williamson are part of a network of volunteers that functions as an informal hotline, taking distress from people on the Greek border. Williamson began collecting pushback testimonies from undocumented people on the Turkish border in 2020 when she was working as a nurse doing casework for NGOs. Since then, she has been one of the default contacts for refugees in distress. However, Williamson's ability to help is limited. The heightened risk of criminalization has chased many NGOs and civil actors from the region. "The trick is to always convince people to call the emergency services," There is just nothing else to rescue, and rescue-wise, that can be done. No NGOs are allowed to intervene. There is not really much else that we can do, Williamson told MEE. The crackdown by the Greek authorities on NGO activities in the region has created a vacuum of accountability on the islands, with many disappearances going undocumented. In a press release on May 25th, the NGO Doctors Without Borders estimated that 940 refugees had gone missing on the island of Lesbos. According to Williamson, the figure is likely to be much higher. Williamson said, "If you tally up the number of people, even just the number of people who go missing, we truly have no idea. We've heard the stories of people being arrested and taken to prison where they are not given a translator. They are not given a lawyer. They are not given a phone. This one guy said that he was taken to a mental hospital and sedated for like a year and then just thrown back on the streets." For Tommy Olsen, a Norway-based volunteer who runs Aegean Boat Report, which monitors people movement in the Aegean Sea, between Greece and Turkey, the surge in disappearances corresponds to a heightened risk of pushbacks. Olsen told MEE, "People contact me when they have arrived. They have run from the beach and into the woods somewhere. They're basically scared to be found by the authorities because most of them who speak with have tried it many times before. They have been beaten. They have been robbed. Some of them have been raped. Of course, they have every reason to be afraid. So it's not about what they read. It's about personal experience, right?" In 2020, a prosecutor on the island of Kos charged Olsen with crimes related to alleged smuggling. Before that, he was able to collaborate with the local NGOs to coordinate rescues. Olsen said, "The NGOs told me, please don't call us anymore. We can do something with the information you provide because the Greek authorities say you are a criminal." Williamson was arrested in Chios in May 2021 following the announcement of an investigation into more than 30 NGOs and civil actors in September 2020. Williamson said, "That silenced a lot of those groups. Some of them shut down. Some people left Greece and started operating elsewhere." Williamson had all her devices removed and was strip searched by the authorities. "This marked the beginning of a drawn-out investigation that is still continuing," she said. "We are very aware that's just a form of intimidation. There is no legal basis to do it whatsoever. We are not going to stop because even if we can stop people from being pushed back, we can at least be aware of how often it's happening and how it's happening." Meanwhile, ABC News reported at least 79 migrants have drowned and hundreds more are missing and feared dead after their overloaded boat capsized and sank in open seas off Greece in one of Europe's deadliest shipping disasters in recent years. As ABC News reported, as a painstaking search for survivors continued, a European rescue support charity said it believed around 750 people were on board the 20 to 30 meter long vessel when it sank recently. The UN's migration agency estimated there were up to 400 passengers.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.